Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Cover to Cover. This week's show is a special of Derek Landy. Derek Landy, you may know from his Skullduggery Pleasant series. And I was lucky enough to interview Derek this week to talk about his brand new book, Kingdom of the Wicked. This is the seventh book of the Skullduggery Pleasant series. And as I said, I wanted in the sort of, we're coming up to Halloween now. And there's all skeletons and werewolves and things obviously involved in the Skullduggery Pleasant series. So I thought it'd just be nice to dedicate a show to someone who's, you know, he's become a very sort of a renowned author in Ireland and obviously all over the world, as you'll hear in the interview. So I hope you enjoy this interview I did with Derek, and we'll talk a little bit more after this interview. Skullduggery Pleasant, Kingdom of the Wicked, is the seventh in the series of Skullduggery Pleasant books by Dublin author Derek Landy. The series began back in 2007 and has gone from strength to strength ever since. Derek joins me now on the phone. Hiya, Derek. Thanks so much for talking to me today. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of the of the series. So, for the uninitiated out there, can you tell us who the skeleton detective Skullduggery Pleasant is?
Basically, Skullduggery is a 400-year-old dead man. He's he is a skeleton. He dresses like a private eye from the 40s. And basically, he himself and his teenage partner pretty much fight crime, solve mysteries, fight monsters, and save the world.
Yeah.
Pretty much every book.
Yeah, so what's the storyline, anyway, for the new book, Kingdom of the Wicked?
The new one,
without spoiling too much for, for people that read the series.
Well, basically, every one of these books has its own identity.
Mm.
So the first book was pure adventure.
Yeah.
The second one was like a monster movie. The third one was a whodunit. The fourth one was a revenge flick. The fifth one was Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The sixth one was a superhero story.
Yeah.
And this one is science fiction.
Yeah.
And for me, as a writer, it's, I look at them and I give them these distinct genres every time because it helps me to stop making each book just like the one before.
Yeah. But
they all have different sensibilities.
Yeah.
So, because Kingdom of the Wicked is technically science fiction, then I'm able to include things like alternate dimensions, and there is a very big nod to Japanese manga and anime, and it's that is the wonderful thing about these books for me because.
Yeah.
It's basically an excuse to write whatever I want, which is wonderful.
There's a lot of freedom involved in the stories. So where did the inspiration come for Stephanie and Valkyrie and Skullduggery? Where did the inspiration come from?
Basically, the idea popped into my head in 2005, and I was brought up in the outskirts of Dublin, on a farm, on a family farm, and after I basically got kicked out of college, I am a wonderful role model for kids everywhere. I really am. I got expelled from art college.
Oh my God.
I think is a feat in itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Spent the next 10 years working on the family farm.
Yeah.
Teaching myself how to write, and I focus on screenplays. I got two Irish movies made that didn't exactly make me any money.
Yeah.
Basically, in 2005, I was over in London in the summer to meet with producers to try and get my next film made, and the idea for Skullduggery just popped into my head. His name came first. It wasn't as if I had an idea for a skeleton detective.
Yeah, yeah.
I searched around for, you know, an appropriately cool name. His name popped into my head. It told me who he was, what he was, and basically that's it. Ideas, you know, they don't generally arrive so fully formed. But this one really did.
So it was like divine intervention, basically. This idea just suddenly, you know, appeared.
yeah. So then when I had him, and you know, I mean, I was in that hotel room in London. It was the Regent Palace.
In
Piccadilly. Very cheap. I was on like the seventh floor. It was really hot, really uncomfortable. It was the middle of summer. And the idea popped into my head, and basically within about 3 or 4 minutes, I was writing a conversation in my notebook between Skullduggery and someone else about what it was like to be dead, what it was like to be a skeleton.
Yeah.
And I realized that the person he was talking to was a girl. So actually, the two main characters now are a 400-year-old skeleton and a teenage girl. And that's how it happened.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. So, it's a bit of a stupid question, but do you believe there is a supernatural out there? You know,
I don't know.
It's hard to decide, isn't it? I suppose with all the
I think
stuff out there.
Writing about his stuff allows me to. I tend to be a very logical person. There isn't a whole lot of stuff I do believe in.
Well, there's a lot of scope out there, in fairness. Do you know what I mean? You can think of all the other things in, that were like werewolves that were in the new book.
I would love to have lived, you know, a few hundred years ago. When superstitions were actually, a lot more fun than mere religion, vampires. I would love to believe in werewolves.
Well, they were still burning people at the stakes, I think, though, a couple of hundred years ago.
There's always a downside, you know. Every person's fun, there is a downside.
Yeah, so, I mean, you were saying that Valkyrie Stephanie came into your mind. Was it a conscious decision to have a female, like, a lead character? It just happened?
Yeah, it just happened. And when I thought about it, obviously, you know, in those early stages, as in, you know, the first hour of getting the idea, I could have changed everything. But the thing is, if you have a 400-year-old mentor who, you know, is seasoned and he's a genius and he's so capable, and you partner him up with a teenage boy, then it becomes not so much a father and son, but a mentor and student relationship. It becomes about being a man and how the boy has to prove himself to his mentor, to go through the rites of passage to become a man, you know, because there would immediately be that kind of, not rivalry, but, but a very subtle...
Might have been like stereotypes.
A proving ground, exactly.
Yeah.
But because it was a teenage girl, she automatically assumes she is his equal. You know, so, and boys don't do that. You know, they would not do that. It would always be about proving themselves. Whereas a girl, of course, I'm equal. You know, I mean, why wouldn't I be? So it stopped that relationship from being about a teacher and a student. And it immediately, like in the first book, she was immediately saying, we are partners. I'm not your sidekick, I'm your partner. And so over the course of 7 books, a partnership has grown.
And she's grown up a lot, I think, over the last
I mean,
books.
Now she's 17.
So, I mean, I think I read somewhere there's going to be 9 books, allegedly, in the series. Can you give us any sort of hints as to what the future holds? This is the thing. Are you planning? Are you already thinking in your head about book 9? Or are you literally just going to just see how it goes with book 8 and book 9 and then plan the end when it comes?
I'm kind of halfway in between. I'm not the type of writer who plans out everything. Because I found that I want to tell a story only once. And if I plan it out on paper with too much detail, if I don't leave room for surprises spontaneity, then I get bored because, in effect, I've already told his story to myself in points on a page. So I know over the course of the series, I've known what each book is about, but I haven't necessarily known what happens. And so with the final two books, you know, the last one in particular, I know again what it's about because in order to plan a series over nine books, you need, you know, these like tentpoles. But as far as, you know, what happens or you know, how it ends, I haven't a clue.
That's fantastic.
And I've, you know, I mean, I've said before that this is, I am as worried as anyone else.
Don't be worrying about it.
Because, I mean, you know, the readers, especially like these days, when the readers exist online.
You know,
that's
definitely.
Where they live, that's where they become friends, that's where the communities grow. You get to read their theories on what's going to happen and what isn't and what has happened. And then you get to read, you know, their predictions and their fears. And they know me by now and they know the sheer delight I take in killing a character that they absolutely love. It really depends on where the story takes itself beyond a certain point in the final book.
So does like automatic feedback, does that affect the way you write, or do you just sort of like take it in, just sort of register it and then get on with what you're doing?
You register it. I think letting it affect what you write is a mistake. Now what that does mean is that you take that into account at the very start. And so you know, when I was planning out these books after the first one, and I realized, okay, there is an audience here, and hopefully it will grow, and they will, you know, they will start to compile their theories. And what if they guess at the twist? And basically, I at that early stage, you know, when I was coming up with the overall story, I made sure it wasn't simple. It wasn't an easy one to guess or predict. But I think if you, in the course of writing, if you let their theories affect you, then I don't think that's the healthiest of avenues to go down. It stops the book from being what it is. And it starts being a reaction to everyone else's expectations. So you really, the only comments online that you must take on board is about the quality. You know, you can't take on board anything about the story or, you know, the characters, but the quality of the writing. Absolutely.
So where do you get the inspiration for you've got the character names. You've got like Tanith Low, Valkyrie Kane, Melancholia St. Clair, Vorian Scapegrace, and the obvious one of, you know, Skulduggery Pleasant, we've spoke about already. Where do you get the inspiration for these bizarre names, or is it just, do you just make stuff up?
It's when I came up with Skulduggery, it was wonderful. Within 3 minutes, I had five names. I had China Sorrows, Ghastly Bespoke, Mr. Bliss, Serpine, and Tanith Low. And each of those names told me everything about these characters. And I you know, I was there. I was like, this is excellent. This is easy. This is so cool. If I do, you know, finish his book, and, you know, if there are sequels, this is going to be so simple because, yeah. you know, already within 3 minutes, six names have
yeah.
appeared to me.
Yeah.
Since then, it hasn't quite been so easy. So basically, what I have done is every time I hear, like, a word, an interesting word that could become a name, I write it down in my little notebook.
Sort of store it away and... Store it away and play play with it again later,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, you know, just like compile a list. And what has happened is the more signings I do and the more events I do and the more people I meet, in any signing queue, I can guarantee there is at least three people with a name either so unique and new that I've never heard it before.
Yeah.
Or foreign and exotic that I haven't heard before.
But that's a good one. I'll write that one down.
Or just so strong and so immediately arresting and so provocative.
Yeah.
That basically I come away from every signing with a pocket full of little post-it notes of names. Like at the moment, my desk is littered with folded up post-it notes. If I pick one up at random, this is a girl that I've just come off a tour there last month. Her name is actually Kali. It's K-A-L-I.
Oh, nice.
And that is, you know, the goddess of death. and that's her name. That is an actual girl's
name. There's a character, definitely.
And so, So, so basically when it comes to new characters, I basically... I go through my list of of reader names and odd words.
Yeah. No, that'd be amazing. Like, start reading the book and there's your name.
Yeah.
Like one of the characters is your name.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, like, it's happened again and again. Like, I had a vampire called Kaelin.
Yeah.
And Kaelin was a boy I had signed a book for in the last book.
Oh, wow.
One of the bad guys is a girl called... Ekitana, and she was a girl I met last year. so the readers...
they help you with the names, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I know this is like going to be like choosing between your children, but do you have a favourite character that you write for in the books?
I have to say it's Valkyrie.
Yeah.
I have to. A, because while the books are called Skullduggery Pleasant, she is the main character. These books are generally from her point of view.
Yeah.
So I have to spend the most time with her. And if I didn't love her, then, you know, it would be a drag.
Yeah.
The other reason that I name her is because she is the only person, she is the only character who is based on a real person. So if I didn't name her as my favourite, then the
you'd be in trouble.
Valkyrie would find out. And she'd hit me.
Oh, how cool is that for a name, though, Valkyrie?
Yeah. It is pretty awesome.
But she's been through the ringer a bit, hasn't she? Over the past couple of books, you know, being chopped up and.
It's. I mean, I love my characters. I truly do. Even though I am so sadistic and mean.
you have to be sometimes.
Yeah. But I mean, I love them. I mean, and. You know, I mean, now that we've got only two books left, if you go onto, you know, the blog or the Facebook or whatever else, when the readers start talking about, oh my God, we only have two books left, and I just know he's going to kill.
Who's he going to kill next?
And they get really worried, and, you know, and you know, the thing is, I am as worried because I know me, and I am sadistic. And I really don't want to hurt either of them because, you know, they, Skullduggery and Valkyrie have changed my life completely.
Yeah, hugely.
Yeah, so I mean, I would love to send them off into the sunset.
You know, it's not going to happen now, is it?
That we'll never hear about. But, I can't trust me, you know?
Terrible. You can't even trust yourself.
Exactly,
isn't it? Terrible.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, Skullduggery Pleasant, the movie. Are the rumours true that are flying around?
Basically, back when all this started, like, the book was published in 2007. And
yeah.
A few months after that, myself and my agent, we went to Hollywood. And we spent a week going around L.A. because, you know, all of the studios wanted to buy the rights. Everyone wanted the next Harry Potter.
Yeah, yeah.
I met amazing, like, I sat down with Steven Spielberg, you know, for 15 or 20 minutes. And that was just awesome. I was just, you know, sitting in his office just grinning.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And my agent, Michelle Kasp, in London, you know, who is a professional.
Yeah.
You know, she's absolutely a professional. She was sitting in his office and grinning as much as I was.
Oh, I'd say he has that effect on people.
Grinning at Steven Spielberg. We eventually we sold the rights to Warner Brothers.
Okay.
And after 3 years, we got the final script back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was terrible.
Oh, no.
It was literally the worst thing I've ever read. Not just a bad adaptation of the book, but just a really bad script.
Yeah.
So I was really hoping they wouldn't make it because it would be awful. Thankfully, Warner's agreed with me, and they realized they had just went with the wrong director and the wrong writer, and they took it down an avenue that there was no coming back from.
Yeah.
Since then, I have got the rights back.
Oh, fantastic.
Basically, for the last 18 months, I've been saying no to studios and turning down offers.
Yeah.
And I've been working on the script myself in between writing a load of books and being on tour.
Yeah.
So now the script is in really good shape.
Mm.
It's not exactly the book because it can't be.
No.
But it's in the same spirit.
Mm.
And it is completely my voice. It's like I view the script as a reinterpretation of the first book.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
And now that I have the script in a really strong, solid form, now is the time to get someone else involved. So,
yeah.
So now I have begun speaking to people. So,
yeah, yeah.
So probably, you know, hopefully before Christmas there will be an announcement that a new deal has been made.
Fantastic.
It doesn't mean the movie will go ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
But it we'll just begin that process again.
Yeah, yeah. So things will be a step further, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, are the Skullduggery Pleasant books your only outlet? Or I know you did a novel for the World Book Day, a small version. So, is Skullduggery your only outlet at the moment, or are you working on lots of other things at the same time?
When all this began, I had a wonderful, wonderful plan. It was going to be awesome. I would write a Skullduggery book in the first half of the year, and then something else in the second half.
Yeah,
and I would do that every year. However, it has not quite worked out as smoothly.
Yeah.
Basically, what I didn't realize when all this began was that the more books you sell, the more popular they become, the more you have to go on tour.
Yeah.
And the more places you have to visit, and the more interviews you have to do, like this one, but this is a wonderful joy.
Yeah.
So the less actual time you have to focus on other things. So basically, I've been stuck with Skullduggery since I started in 2005. And astonishingly, because I've got a short attention span.
It's not a bad thing, in fairness.
Yeah. It wasn't the best trait to have in school.
Well,
it wasn't exactly the best trait to have in college.
Might explain why you got kicked out of art college.
I had assumed, you know, I could maybe write 3 Skullduggery books before I got like bored or before I started to feel hemmed in, or you know, but it's just been I think it is because I approach every book with its own genre that I've managed to keep it, for me, in the writing of it, absolutely fresh and new every single time. So I'm far from bored, and I'm having a fantastic time. And, you know, I mean, I do want to do something completely new. I really do.
It's time at the end of the day.
Trying
to find time to do everything that you want to do is never...
But, you know, I mean, as, you know, because being a writer is just so unsure anyway, you know, like, as a profession, it's up there with, like, being an actor, you know, in terms of the uncertainty of the next job or the reception of the current job. It's just a very shaky profession. So to actually, you know, be under that kind of pressure, you know, where you don't have in as much time as you would thought, that's a wonderful, wonderful complaint.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, it would be completely different if I had all the time in the world.
Yeah.
Because that means that school degree isn't, like, doing that well.
Yeah.
But I have no time. And so, you know, I take that as a good sign.
So is book eight in the, are you sort of, have you started on book eight yet?
I will be.
Sorry, I'm not going to put you under pressure. Where is book eight?
I've because I was on tour August and September.
Plugging the, you know, doing the press for this book, I suppose. It takes up a lot of time.
Yeah, and then I took a few days off to play video games.
As you do.
So now I'm back writing some odds and ends for Skullduggery, but I will be officially back on the books, I'd say within 2 weeks, I'd say so.
Yeah. I mean, are you quite a disciplined writer? Do you sort of say, right, I'm gonna write for 2 hours today and stick to it, or are you just sort of, you just like a casual do it when you feel like it?
I'm absolutely both. It's just
at
different stages. In the first, like, if a book takes 6 months to write, the first 3 months I will be casual. I will, a few hours a day, you know, I don't mind if I take a day or two off.
Yeah.
I don't mind if I'm playing video games for a weekend or I go away, or, you know, I'm very casual.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. I'm writing all of the really cool bits.
Yeah.
And I'm just getting into the flow again and figuring out what kind of book this is. Because I know, and I'm fine with that level of writing, because I know that by the third month, by the halfway point, I will become obsessed.
Yeah. And the publisher's there going, so what have you got for me?
Yeah. Yeah, they know.
You're like, I've been playing video games for 3 months.
Not my fault.
Where's my book? So as a kid growing up in Dublin, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you always have sort of this aspiration that you were going to go into writing? Or I know you said you went to art college.
I wanted to be either an artist or a writer. My ideal job would have been writing and drawing comics.
Right, okay.
I love comics and I still do. As it turned out, I wasn't destined to be an artist. I was, you know, the writing, you know, that was with me from the very start. I was always a writer. And I always loved it so much, and every one of my teachers knew, you know, when I, you know, I would be writing the longest essay, the imagination would just go completely haywire. It has been the one constant. In my life. So, I was. And, you know, as I said, it's not exactly, you know, the most solid of careers. So, you know, when I was, you know, living at home, you know, living with the parents, working on the farm, you know, the movies hadn't really paid off. You know, for the parents, of a writer in, you know, of a struggling writer, it's kind of, it's not the best because they're always worried about him. You know, like my sisters and my brother, they went to college. They actually finished college. you know, they did well. You know, they chose careers. I was always the black sheep. I was always the one with his head in the clouds. I was the one who was insistent that I could make this work and I could be a writer.
Yeah.
No matter what, you know, statistics showed or the, you know, the actual chances were of me being a success. But but now because of Skullduggery, I've gone from being the, you know, the black sheep to the golden child. and now my parents can't really stand my brother or sisters. They think they're rubbish.
Yeah, you hear of all these sort of actors and writers and they say, oh, I was at school and my school reporter was like, oh, never amount to anything.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, I want to be an actor or I want to be a writer. Yeah. And they say, nah, you'll never do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then, you know, a couple of years down the line.
And it's actually scary. You know, I mean, the difference between, I mean, because of Skullduggery, I am lauded for keeping faith in my dream, for not giving up.
Oh, definitely.
You know, for persevering. Mm. You know, and everyone says, "Well done." You know, he had confidence. But the thing is, it was that moment in that hotel room in London, when the name popped into my head.
Yeah.
That changed everything. If that hadn't happened, if, I mean, I've said this before because it is a terrifying thought.
Yeah.
If I was in that hotel room and someone had passed my door, like speaking loudly, then I would...
Disrupted your train of thought at the time.
And that idea would not have popped into my head. So instead of being lauded for following my dream, I would be condemned or being completely delusional.
Yeah. Well, you could have been milking cows or something.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's you know, it is a terrifyingly sobering thought.
Yeah.
That all of this could, you know,
could have turned out so differently.
You know, if someone had passed my door.
Yeah. No, I find the series, it's got a very Irish feel to it, you know, like obviously like people, you know, in Dublin can associate with a lot of the landmarks that are mentioned, where these are like the battles that are mentioned, you know, like in O'Connell Street, there's these big fights going on. And so what sort of reception do you get out from people outside of Ireland? I know it's huge everywhere at the moment, but
it's, you know, like basing it in Ireland, in Dublin, and being absolutely precise about that was a conscious decision. The safer route would probably have been to just not really name where it was, really, you know, be too specific about what nationality everyone was. But I figured, you know, like being a distinctly British did not exactly harm Harry Potter.
No, exactly. Yeah,
and so I said, okay, I will make this a distinctly Irish.
Mm.
And the thing I've realised is that it really doesn't matter where the books are set, as long as the reader can tell that it's authentic. Then, you know, the neighbourhood in Dublin is pretty much just like the neighbourhood in Liverpool or in Manchester or in London or, you know, in Sydney. You know, it's as long as you are specific. I've learned that is a lot better than being vague.
Yeah. Oh, no, it definitely adds to the books. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's nice that even, like, you can actually picture these fight scenes, you know, going on. The descriptions are, you know, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. So, it's you know, so, like obviously, you know, the books are successful in the UK. And so every time I'm over there, we have a growing, a core group of readers
who
basically will travel wherever I'm going.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are hysterical. They yeah. are. They are so funny. They're largely teenage girls.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely mental cases.
Do you get people like dressing up as
yes.
Valkyrie and
that is utterly utterly cool.
Oh
that
wow!
That is so much fun. I mean, I've had you know people come as Valkyrie, as
yeah.
Skullduggery, as Tanith.
Yeah.
You know, and they go to such lengths, and they look awesome. You know, so it's fantastic, and you know it. Back in August, I was on tour in Australia and New Zealand, and you know it's just I mean where was I? I was in Perth, and it was just supposed to be a very small stock signing
yeah.
in a bookshop.
Yeah.
But the bookshop had advertised it as a public signing.
Oh, okay.
So we turned up. We had about half an hour, you know, of free time, and
yeah.
I was going to like saunter in, sign a few books, and saunter back out again.
Yeah.
And there's a line of people up the street, and I'm going, "What?" And I'm walking in, and everyone starts screaming
oh,
and cheering,
wow.
and everyone around is like looking around because they think there's an actor or a pop star. And
it's
just
Brad Pitt.
Me going, "Hello, excuse me," and you know, so it's just getting more and more like that.
Yeah.
And it, you know it's testament you know to the you know the readers that
yeah
you know and the youth of today
yeah exactly.
Who basically are prepared to treat a writer with as much enthusiasm as they would a singer
yeah
and you know like that's just astonishing.
Oh, it's amazing that books can do that, you
yeah.
know, in this day and age as well.
Exactly, yeah.
So I've got a copy of Kingdom of the Wicked in my hand at the moment, and the covers for the books are really striking, you know, they jump out of you from
yeah.
the bookshelves. Who designs the covers?
Well, basically, I mean, I've said this before, I think everyone agrees that I could design the covers.
Yeah, I was thinking with your comic book
yes,
background.
Yes, yes. You know, and you know, I mean, before I was kicked out, I had a year of art college under my belt.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could do these. I just choose not to.
Yeah.
And instead, I let a gentleman called Tom Percival
mm-hmm.
do it, who actually also has his own books out for younger kids.
Yeah.
And they're just astonishing. You know, they're picture books, and they're just beautiful.
Mm.
So, but the covers are just an essential. They have become an essential part of the entire process
yeah.
of the books in a way that I haven't really seen before.
Mm.
You know, like on the basis of the covers, Tom has become like an idol to all of these aspiring artists.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Because the covers are just fantastic.
Yeah, and the little nameplate things at the start of each character of each
yes.
chapter as well are really
yeah,
distinctive.
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, it took guts on the part of HarperCollins at the very start to be brave enough to put a skeleton in a hat and a suit on the front cover.
Yeah.
With as much style as Tom
yeah.
has provided, because it's not so much, like, it would never scare off a kid,
yeah.
it would never scare off a teenager, it would scare off the granny at Christmas who wants to buy something for her niece or nephew, and, oh, no, I won't buy this, it looks scary. You know, so it takes a bit of guts to say, you know, the risk is
yeah, oh yeah, huge risk
is
yeah.
worth it.
Mm.
And the covers are just astonishing. I have a few of them framed
yeah.
and on my wall
yeah, yeah.
around the house. So yeah,
that's it. They're artworks in
yeah.
in themselves.
Yeah.
So obviously there's out there, there's all these aspiring writers and people that are, you know, everyone has a book in them, they say. So any advice for people out there that say, oh, I'd love to be a writer and I think I've got a book in my head. What would you advise people to, how would you advise them to start?
Most of them, I'd say keep the book in your head. that would be the cynical.
There's some advice.
The kind of advice that I would have loved to have been given when I was a struggling writer would be basically you've got to forget what is big now.
That's the thing, trying to be the next Harry Potter
thing. It'll be old hat, but by the time you edit it and rewrite it and edit and rewrite and then publish, it's a few years down the line.
So
if you're writing a dystopian fiction now, I would change it slightly. if you're writing paranormal romance and vampires and love, I would really, really change my approach there. And the same thing, you know, for adult writers, if you're writing 50 Shades of Grey, I would just
I think Twilight's got a lot to answer for, hasn't it, really?
It really does. But yeah, you can't go by what is popular. You cannot like base your story around something as cynical as market research. I put in Skullduggery, I didn't know what I was doing. I knew how to structure a screenplay. I knew how that worked. I hadn't a clue how to write a book. I didn't really know the rules. So I packed it full of everything that I wanted to write about, which is why it's a mishmash of every genre. It's horror, adventure, it's comedy, it's crime. And basically, I mean, it sounds amazingly corny, but I had fun. And I think fun is contagious. And if a writer has fun writing it, the reader will have fun reading it.
That's it. They'll read it in your in your words.
Exactly. Because, you know, really, if you have any talent, but you are brimming with enthusiasm and energy, then the words will pop off the page. So, and if you based your book on market research, on what is number one now, where is the joy?
Exactly.
You have to enjoy it.
Originality, even.
Yeah, you know. So, you know, it sounds awful, but you know, like, it sounds completely ridiculous. But you would have to have fun. So that would be my one piece of advice.
So I mean, I know you probably don't get time in between, you know, playing computer games and the cows and stuff, but do you get to read?
Oh, I do.
Do you get to read? What sort of authors do you like to read yourself?
Basically, I read mostly crime.
Okay.
People like Elmore Leonard and Joe Orr Lansdale, and Alex Barkley, just people who can do crime, but who know how to write a snappy one-liner. You know, these are funny people. They are funny writers, and it's all about character. It's all about dialogue, and it's all about character, and it's just glorious to read. Another writer that, I mean, at the moment, as usual, you know, I've got like 17 books all halfway through.
I know the feeling. I suffer from the same.
I'm right now, I'm reading Red Country by Joe Abercrombie.
Okay.
Who is startlingly fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm reading A Dance with Dragons, or of Dragons, by, you know, the Game of Thrones. And anything by Colin Bateman. Who is hysterically funny.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, you know, I mean, I've got You know, and actually, there's another book on my desk, but it is The Enemy by Charlie Higson.
Oh, he's a fantastic writer.
Yeah. I'm actually very select when it comes to writing because I don't get as much time. Sorry, when it comes to reading.
Yeah.
Because I don't get as much time as...
To do it as you'd like to. Yeah.
I'm very particular. And there are writers out there, not only for adults, but also for the age group in which I write, that I would never read because they're diabolically awful.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say who they are. But
Go on, name them.
I couldn't. Just so bad.
Yeah.
But you get that everywhere.
Yeah.
There are really, really bad books.
Yeah.
That sell astonishingly well.
Yeah. Exactly. Well. Exactly. I was going to say that was hyped to the eyeballs, and you know, I think I read half of it, and I was like, what is all the fuss about? It's, you know.
Yeah. It's just.
It's not much of a story, to be honest.
When I was in Australia, my first week. The first bookshop I went into, they had, you know, the chart in, you know, on the first two shelves.
Yeah.
It was number one, 50 Shades of Grey, 50 Shades Pre, 50 Shades whatever, and then number four, Skullduggery Peasant. So basically, I'm being kept off the number one spot by all of the mammies in Australia. And thank you, Mary. That's just wonderful.
Well, at least you're number four behind those three, you know, the way those three books are selling.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And still, it doesn't look as if there's any sort of let up.
Yeah, it's. But I've been talking to a few people in the business, a few booksellers, and they have predicted that, like, give it 7 months and people will start denying they ever read it. It's just, you know, oh dear, what was I thinking?
I think people are starting that already, to be honest. It was like, have you read it? No. I wouldn't read that muck.
I would never read that.
I wouldn't read that muck. But secretly, they have all the books on the shelf at home. Oh dear. Anyway, okay. Derek, thanks so much for talking to me today.
It's been
an absolute honour talking to you. Skullduggery Pleasant, Kingdom of the Wicked is available now in all good bookshops and it's published by HarperCollins.
And it's awesome.
It is awesome. Is it? It's available in ebook as well?
Yes.
Fantastic. So if you're into your ebooks, I try and push the ebook.
Nice.
I want more people to sort of embrace the two, but obviously you'd rather have this big, a nice book to carry around. But thanks again, Derek, so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, cheers, Derek. Thank you. That was me there talking to Derek Landy earlier this week about his brand new book, Skullduggery Pleasant, Kingdom of the Wicked. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did doing the interview. I'll say Derek is a lovely guy to talk to, as you probably heard there in the interview. And as I say, I've loved the series since it first started back in 2007 and sort of read every consequent book. And so he's pretty prolific in his writing in the fact that he releases like one book a year, you know, whereas a lot of authors, they struggle to maybe get a book out every 5 years or so. But in that respect, you kind of, you know, he doesn't let you down. You get a book once a year. So hopefully, you know, this time next year we'll be celebrating book eight, and I'll be talking to you about the next instalment, the second to last instalment of the Skullduggery Pleasant series. And I hope, like me, you'll be looking forward to that. Anyway, as I said, I want to dedicate this show. As I say, we're coming up to Halloween now, and I kind of wanted to dedicate this show to, you know, Derek and his writing and his new book. And I thought maybe I'd read you a little bit from the first chapter so you can get a bit of a feeling for the book. It might seem a little bit out of context because obviously if you haven't read the other books, it might not make much sense. But we'll give it a couple of pages a go and we'll have a get on. So the first chapter, The Butterfly and the Wolf. "I'm a butterfly," screamed the fat man as he ran, flapping his arms like two really flabby, really rubbish wings. "You're actually not," Valkyrie Kane told him for the eighth time. He ran around her in a big circle, bathed in moonlight, and she just stood there with her head down. He wasn't wearing a shirt, and moments earlier she had to drag her eyes away from his wobbling bosoms before they made her feel queasy. Now that his trousers were starting their inexorable slide downwards, she was averting her gaze altogether. "Please," she said, "pull up your trousers." "Butterflies don't need trousers," he screeched. A moment later, those trousers landed by her feet. She took out her phone and dialed. "He's in his underpants," she said angrily. Skullduggery Pleasant's smooth voice sounded uncharacteristically hesitant. "I'm sorry? Who is in his underpants?" "Jerry Houlihan," she said. "He thinks he's a butterfly. Apparently they don't wear trousers." "And is he a butterfly?" "He isn't." "You're quite sure?" "Quite. He could be a butterfly dreaming he's a man." "Well, he's not. He's a big fat man dreaming he's a big fat butterfly. What the hell am I supposed to do?" There was another hesitation. "I'm not sure. You don't happen to have a large net handy, do you?" "I want to hit him. I want to hit you, but I also want to hit him." "You can't hit him. He's an ordinary mortal under some kind of magical influence. It's not his fault he's acting this way. I assume you have him out of public view at the very least. Valkyrie? Valkyrie, are you there?" "I'm here," she said duly. "He's starting leaping with every third step. It's kind of mesmerising. I can only imagine. The cleaver should be with you in an hour or so. Can you contain him until then?" She gripped the phone tighter. "You're not serious. You can't be serious. We've saved the world. I personally have saved the world. This here, right now, this is not something I do. This is something other people do. And then you and me laugh about it later. We do what needs to be done, Valkyrie. Once you've handed him over to the cleavers, meet me in Fisborough." She sighed. "Another busy night?" "It certainly looks that way. I really must go. Sally York has just set fire to her knees." The line went dead. Valkyrie gritted her teeth and stuffed the phone back in the pocket of her black trousers. This is not how a 17-year-old girl was supposed to spend her evenings. She blamed the Council of Elders for making this a priority. Yes, she accepted that it was a major problem that previously unremarkable mortals were suddenly developing magical abilities, aside from the threat they posed to themselves and others. They also risked exposing the existence of magic to the general public, and that was not something that could be allowed to happen. But why, of all the cases that were popping up all over Ireland, did Valkyrie have to deal with the weird ones who thought they were butterflies? There were a few dozen sedated mortals back in the sanctuary, and not one of those was as weird and unsettling as Jerry Houlihan in his underpants. Valkyrie frowned and wondered why she couldn't hear Jerry's footsteps anymore. Then she looked up and saw him flying through the night sky, flapping his arms and squealing with glee. "Jerry!" she shouted. "Jerry Houlihan, get down here!" But Jerry just giggled and giggled, unsteady in the air but flying, definitely flying. He reversed course, flapping back towards her. Stupidly, she looked up as he passed directly overhead. The image seared itself into her mind and she felt a little piece of herself die. Jerry veered off, drifting from the safety of the park towards the bright streetlights of Dublin City. Valkyrie reached up, felt the air, felt how the spaces connected, and then she pulled a gust of wind right into him, knocking him back towards her. She needed a rope or even a piece of string, just something to anchor him in place, like a fat man-shaped kite. "Jerry," she said, she called, "can you hear me? I'm a butterfly," he panted happily. "I can see that, and a very pretty butterfly you are too, but aren't you getting tired? Even butterflies get tired, Jerry. They have to land, don't they? They have to land because their wings get tired." "My wings are getting tired," he said, puffing heavily now. I know they are. You should rest them. You should land." He dipped lower and she jumped. Tried to grab his foot, but he beat his arms faster and bobbed up high again. "No," he said. "Butterflies fly. Fly high in the sky." He was gasping for air now, losing his rhythm. And no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't keep himself from dipping lower once more. Valkyrie jumped, grabbed him, closed her eyes and tried to send her mind to a peaceful place. Jerry was sweating from all that exertion and his skin was warm and sticky and hairy. Valkyrie remembered the good times in her life and she pulled him out of the sky, handhold after handhold. He made a last-ditch effort to soar away and she had to grip the folds of flesh on his hips to hold him in place. Then Jerry gave up and stopped flapping and Valkyrie fell screaming beneath his weight. "I'm not a butterfly," Jerry sobbed as Valkyrie squirmed and wriggled beneath him. So that's the first... I'll give you a little taster there of the very first book, as I said, from Derek Landy there, Kingdom of the Wicked. Check it out. As I said, it's in all good bookshops at the moment. It's in the bestseller. I think it's in the top 10. If you go into Easons, you can't miss it, really. The front cover is this, you know, Skullduggery's face. And you've got two, like, sort of Yeti-esque creatures behind him. And it says it's number one best-selling author. So you can't go wrong, really. Cold-blooded thriller. That's the words on the front cover. So, as I said, go and check out, you know, look at that one. If you're feeling inclined, go back, read book one, start a book one, and work your way through the series. As I say, you won't be disappointed. As I say, I absolutely love the series, and I hope you will too. So join us next week. where we will have the podcast, the American Podcast Book Show, will be out next week. So I hope you'll enjoy that with our host Joe Donahue over at WAMC in Albany, New York. So, thanks so much for listening to Cover to Cover. And I hope you've enjoyed this Derek Landy special. And happy Halloween.